Have you ever wondered how accessible Japan is for someone living in a wheelchair? On today's show, I talked to Josh Grisdale from Accessible Japan to find out what his experience has been like living and working in Japan for many years. Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Tokyo Podcast. I'm your host, Anthony Joe. And before we get into today's show, I want to talk briefly about a hiking trip that I recently went on to Mount Mitake. And I really enjoyed this hike so much that I wanted to kind of tell you all about it in case you want to come to Japan and you also want to go on this hike. Now, when you come to Japan and you ask people like, hey, where should I go to, you know, go hiking or experience nature or whatever, most people tell you to go to Mount Takao, Takao-san. And I remember I went out there a long time ago when I first moved to Japan, just like once again, because everyone told me that's where you go. So like, okay, go to Mount Takao. And honestly, it was a bit of a letdown for me. I think partially because I come from Canada. And when I think of a mountain, like, you know, Canada, we're famous for the Rocky Mountains. And if you've ever seen pictures of these online, they're massive, right? They're huge. So everyone's like, yeah, go to Mount Takao. It's great. It's really big. You got a nice big hike. You can see overlook of this nice view from the top. So I was expecting something a little bit more grand. And then when I got out there, I was like, well, that's kind of more of a hill than a mountain. But besides that, one of the things I kind of didn't like about Takao-san so much was that, and actually I find kind of, and this is the case in all, in like a lot of Tokyo, is like Tokyo doesn't really have like any real nature to me. It has like manufactured nature. Like it's just the city, I guess, is so big that they need to kind of like pour concrete everywhere. So like even if you find a park or like where I live by the river, it does not a lot of kind of nature there. It doesn't ever feel like you're away from the city. Like the where I live by the river, the concrete that they've poured just goes like right to the edge of the river. Like there's no beach, there's no sand, there's nothing. It just goes right to the edge of the river and then there's water. So it's like, well, okay, that's kind of nice, I guess. But it's like not back home where it's like, you know, you got like 100 feet of beaches and then there's trees and like the city's like way in the background, right? So when I went to Takao-san, I was like, yeah, it's kind of nice, but the trail's like really, and once again, that Japanese safety feature kicks in. Everything's got to be super safe and no risk whatsoever. So like the trail has got like a handrail that runs all the way beside it. And it was even kind of funny. They have a chairlift there that kind of takes you about halfway up the mountain. And the chairlift is like, I don't know, like 10, 15 feet off the ground. It's like not that high, but even the chairlift had this like safety net underneath the whole thing. And I remember just laughing because like in Whistler, when I go like in Whistler Mountain, there's a chairlift, you're like 100 feet in the air. And there's no safety net or nothing. You could just hop off that and, you know, plunge to the bottom if you want. But of course, in Japan, they get, you know, gotta have it super safe. So Takao-san was a bit of a disappointment for me. So recently, I decided to brave the summer heat in Japan and went to Mount Mitake. And Mount Mitake, I think it's actually kind of in that similar area to Takao-san. It's about a couple hours outside of Tokyo. And I did this loop called the Rock Garden. And there's a bunch of different loops that you could do. I did the one called the Rock Garden. And I gotta say, I really enjoyed it a lot. It was like, you really feel you're kind of out in the nature. There's not a lot, like there's no kind of artificial trail or whatever. There's a trail there, but it doesn't feel kind of manufactured. And the Rock Garden kind of gets its name from all these waterfalls and streams that run through the whole area. So I really enjoyed that. It was really nice, actually, because it was so crazy humid in Tokyo. And then you get up there and you're up in the mountains a bit, so it's a bit cooler. And then the stream just provided this kind of natural air conditioning, so to speak, because it was actually quite a bit cooler kind of hiking beside the stream. So I really enjoyed it a lot. And I recommend it to anyone who, you know, is looking for kind of a nice day trip outside of Tokyo. Go check out Mount Takao. Oh, no, sorry. don't go to Mount Takao because that's what everyone recommends. Check out Mount Mitake because that's the one I recommend. And trust me, you will like it a whole lot better. And there's this one section where you're going towards the rock garden. You can go to this falls. I can't remember the name of the falls, but you go down this super steep stairs and there's like a lagoon at the bottom and the falls and all that. It's really, really nice. So definitely recommend checking out. Very easy hike. This, the little journey excursion down to the falls is pretty steep. and it's really rooty, so you know that's a bit of a challenge. But everything else is definitely walkable. It's not that big a deal. And actually, there's some trails there that are quite easy to walk along. And in fact, that gave me the idea for today's show is I saw a guy riding a wheelchair along one of the paths. Like, that's how easy some of the paths are. So some of them are a little bit more harder. They all feel like you're quite, you know, out in nature and up in the mountains is really nice. But some of them, you could, you know, take a motorized wheelchair on it if you had the chair that can actually go off-road. Let me put it that way. And the thing that's interesting about this guy's wheelchair is a company called Will, W-H-I-L-L, I think they're called. And they are a Japanese manufacturer of these electronic wheelchairs, and they design wheelchairs that can go off-road. And the interesting thing about their designs is that the unique part of their design is actually the wheel. So I think if you see a lot of these off-road wheelchairs, typically what they have is like some big ass mountain bike tires strapped to them or some big tire or something like that. So they just take a regular wheelchair, they put bigger, thicker wheels on it, and then they say, oh, now you can go off-road. But what Will has done is they actually took like a regular kind of power chair size wheelchair with those regular small wheels. Those wheels are really small. They must only be about 7-8 inches or something like that. But they redesigned that wheel. And it's hard to describe in the audio, but if you go take a look at their website, you'll see the design. But the wheel itself is quite unique, and the wheel itself allows them to take that chair off-road. And if you look on their website, they got demos of them like riding through snow and over sand and gravel and all these kinds of things. So it's quite a unique design for this chair. But beyond that, they've actually designed the chair to be quite compact. So it's much smaller than a regular power chair. So you can use it in the office. You can use it at home. A friend of mine, actually, she was the ambassador for them for a while, and she used it. And she told me like one of the things she liked about it so much was that in her home, she could just like flip around, do a 360 because the chair, the design of the chair was so small, and the design of the wheels kind of allowed her just to kind of pivot on like one single wheel. Unlike her old power chair, which is massive thing, she had to do like an 18-point turn in her kitchen just to turn around. The wheel, you can just like flip it around, and it's really easy. So it's a kind of a unique chair that allows people to go, you know, off-road to some degree, right? It depends on the trail, but you can go off, certainly more than a regular wheelchair. But then you can also use it kind of in the office and around your home and whatnot as well. And if you want an idea of what it looks like, is if you check out the 2020 keynote that of the WWDC that Apple just recently did, it was interesting to see that Meg Frost, who is the director of product design for Apple Maps, was sitting in one of the wheel chairs. So it goes to show you that this chair has really become quite popular all around the world, and that you know, people who are working at Apple who obviously love design are using this chair as well. So once again, you can use it in the office, you can go off-road, climb Mount Mitake with it as well. So it's kind of an interesting thing to see. And so that got me curious, actually, is like, I wonder how accessibility in Japan has been in the last few years. Because about 8 or 9 years ago, I did an interview with a lady named Ashley Olson. I think it was Tokyo Podcast episode 47. And she runs a website called like Wheelchair Traveling, where she travels around the world in a wheelchair. And she, at the time, wrote this blog article about her trip in Japan. And I reached out to her because I was really curious to see like, what is it like to travel in Japan in a wheelchair? Because for me, walking around, I thought like, oh my God, like how can we, like, first off, you don't see that many people in wheelchairs in Japan at all. I don't know what the deal is. Like, either Japanese people don't get hurt as much, don't have as many spinal injuries, or I suspect the real reason is that Japanese society kind of hides them away because they don't like anything that has kind of a defect, you know? So they view it as a defect, so they just hide them away. That's what I think the real reason is. But you don't see a lot of people in wheelchairs around the city, especially given the city this size. And also, I thought like, oh my God, there's like stairs everywhere. Like there's stairs everywhere. The sidewalks are narrow. The sidewalks are crowded with tons of people. I thought it would be a nightmare for someone with a wheelchair. But then Ashley told me that traveling around Japan was actually relatively easy for her. This was a big, huge surprise for me. So that interview was done about 8 or 9 years ago. I wanted to see if things have improved, if things have changed, and what it's like to actually live here day to day in a wheelchair. So I reached out to Josh Grisdale, who runs the website Accessible Japan, to find out what his experience is like been living in Japan for the last number of years.
Yeah, so I grew up in Canada. And actually, first to give a little bit of credibility to why I have a website about accessibility, I have a disability. It's called cerebral palsy. And that disability affects, it's sort of like having a stroke kind of thing, except it happens when you're very, very young. So I've got some brain damage, and because of that brain damage, my body doesn't move the way that, you know, I intend to. So I need to use a power wheelchair to get around. And so I became interested in Japan back when I was in high school, actually. I was living in the middle of nowhere in Canada, and we actually had a Japanese class. And I thought, you know, maybe in the future I want to get into IT or something like that. So if I can put on my resume that I speak Japanese as well, then that would be, you know, good for my future career possibilities. So I took it for a very selfish reason, but my teacher really instilled a love and an interest in Japan. And so I became more and more interested in this country. And so I first came to Japan after I graduated high school back in 2000. And so we can maybe talk a bit later, but the accessibility has changed quite a bit since then. But I came back a number of times. And then in 2007, I came and started living here permanently. And I've been here ever since. And in 2016, I actually gave up my Canadian citizenship and I became a citizen of the Empire of Japan. So there you go.
Were you nervous at all coming to Japan the first time?
I had, you know, friends here, so I wasn't going to be completely alone with my dad trying to figure things out. I had some Japanese. I took Japanese in the high school there, of course, but, you know, it wasn't really enough for much in terms of conversation right off the bat. So, you know, there's some things I was nervous about, but I was mostly excited. And, you know, even if it didn't work out, it was still going to be a fun adventure.
Because I kind of wondered if maybe like visiting a new area would be kind of a little bit nerve-wracking for you. Because I imagine like when you lived in Canada, you're pretty familiar with the town you lived in, right? You probably knew where to go and whatnot. So coming to a completely new city, you're almost kind of starting from scratch, aren't you? And trying to figure out how to get around.
Oh, yeah. No, I was probably just young and stupid, I guess. But but that helped, I guess. So, but I mean, also that time I didn't leave Tokyo. I think the farthest we went was Hakone. So the next time I came, I was a lot more adventurous and went different places.
So you came to Japan first time in 2000. Yeah, like there wouldn't have been a lot of internet back then. I mean, Japan's pretty far behind when it comes to internet even now. So I can imagine in 2000, it was probably not a lot. So hard to do research, I imagine, on, you know, what it's like to get around Japan, isn't it?
Yeah. I think my mom ended up finding a book in the library in Toronto about, it was, I think, put out by the Red Cross because they had some sort of event in Tokyo back in the mid-90s. And so it was a bit out of date, but at least it had some information. So it was definitely a very different experience than now with, you know, tons and tons of websites and blogs and stuff like that. But, you know, at least there was a little bit of a glimpse of hope in that terms.
What were some of the kind of differences that you noticed for you, like in getting around in Tokyo back then compared to in Canada?
Yeah, I think, well, for me anyways, I lived in rural Canada. So really, if you don't have a car, it's very difficult to go anywhere or do anything.
Right.
So for me, being in Canada is quite limiting in that because I can't drive by myself. So I would always need somebody to help me. So I think the biggest change for me was the fact that you could use trains and subways here in Tokyo to go pretty much, you know, anywhere you want. So that was really exciting for me. And I think the service that they had at the train stations for when you want to go to a location, you tell the staff where it is you want to go. They'll put a ramp out and help you get on the train. But then not only that, they'll call ahead to where it is you're going. And they'll have somebody be, you know, waiting for you when you arrive. And that's because, you know, the Japan's trains run a tight schedule. And so they know exactly when you're going to arrive. And so there'll be somebody waiting for you and to help you out. And I thought that was just really incredible. Unfortunately, in Canada, they don't have anything like that on any of the subways I took in Toronto. But so that was a big, you know, shock that, I could get a lot more places without a lot of extra hassle. And there's some things that definitely that came up that were a bit more of a challenge in terms of, just the way things are built here in Japan. You know, everything's a lot smaller and tighter. Stores are very cramped. Restaurants are small. A lot more stairs than you would find in saying Canada. I think in Canada, because it's so wide, we can sort of build, you know, large buildings and not necessarily need for, have a need for steps. But also, even culturally in Japan, they have a, you know, a genkan at, you know, the door of most places. And so, you know, most restaurants or businesses will have some sort of step at them that sort of made it a bit more difficult. So there's some, you know, getting around is a lot easier, but then getting to the place you want to go to is a bit more difficult at times. So
yeah, that's interesting. Learning, actually, yeah. That's probably a big cultural thing, isn't it? To have that kind of genkan. So you have that kind of like a physical separation between the inside and the outside. Whereas back in Canada, we wouldn't have that.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the thing that always makes me laugh, but also is very frustrating, is that even in a lot of buildings, like if you go to a department store or a high-rise building with restaurants, maybe have, you know, a floor or two of restaurants, and even though the building is completely accessible, a lot of the restaurants will put in a step, an artificial step, just because of that, you know, that feeling of, you know, having a separation, a barrier between, you know, the outside and inside. And so, yeah, the building is completely accessible. There might be accessible toilets right there, elevators and everything like that. But to get into the restaurant, you have to go up a step, which, it's a little bit,
It's like the Japanese smoking, non-smoking rules, you know, where they have that room with, like, no barrier, and, like, half the restaurant is smoking and half the restaurant is not. And they have a little sign that says, like, this area is non-smoking, but there's no barrier, nothing. And they don't see anything wrong with that, you know, so... That's interesting, though, what you said about the transportation, because my previous guest, Tony, who's blind, he said the exact same thing. He lived in Florida, and he said, like, any time you wanted to go somewhere, like in America and Canada, the same. You need a car no matter where you live, unless you live in, say, downtown Toronto, downtown Vancouver, or a major city, you need a car. And he said, like, when he came to Japan, because the train network was so good, it really gave him a sense of freedom to be able to move about on his own without having to ask friends for a ride.
Yeah, I was listening to that podcast, and those blocks, the Braille blocks they're called, they're actually invented in Japan. So it's, you know, kind of a neat fit. In certain areas, Japan is leading the field in that area.
I've always wondered, though, do those things hinder you from getting around?
There's always a constant battle between people who have visual impairments and people who use wheelchairs about those kind of things. They're bumpy, so I try not to roll on them. But they are also useful because they, in general, like you was mentioning, that, you know, they sort of lead to the station, and in the same way, you know, they'll lead to where the elevator is or where the accessible entrance is. So they are useful for me as well.
Right. Yeah. It's kind of an interesting battle between two different groups. Yeah.
For sure.
What do you think has been the push over the last few years to make Japan more accessible?
Yeah, I think there's been a number of things. The biggest thing, of course, is new laws to increase accessibility. The first laws started to come in effect back before 2000, but every couple of years there's been a few more. Japan ratified one of the UN rules about accessibility and discrimination against people with disabilities, and to be compliant with that, they had to make some local rules as well. So because of that, there's been a lot more focus on making public places accessible, transportation accessible. So I think that's been a huge part of it. However, I think there's definitely a part of it that is, you know, uniquely Japanese in that there's a desire to see things through and to do it well, if that makes sense. Like, for example, not to pick on Toronto or anything like that, but when I was in Toronto, they've been talking for ages about making the TTC subway accessible. But even today, there's a number of stations that are not yet accessible. And it keeps saying, oh, we'll have it done by 2015, and then it's by 2020, and then 2025, and it keeps getting pushed back, et cetera. Whereas in Japan, the government set towards making the stations accessible. And now I think it's about 95% of the train stations where there are 3,000 daily users are now accessible. So just the incredible speed that things have been taken up. And because of that, sort of a virtuous circle, if you will, as more things become accessible, then more people with disabilities go out more. And because of that, there people are seeing more the need to do those kind of things. So and then as they see more people with disabilities getting out, then they're more likely to make changes because they've realized the inaccessibility problems that have occurred. So I think it sort of started with legislation from the government, and then it sort of become more of a public discussion, especially with the Paralympics hopefully happening next year.
That's interesting that you said that, though, because I can imagine that, because, as I said earlier, I don't see a lot of people in wheelchairs in Tokyo. I saw more when I was in Vancouver. I don't see a lot of people here. And so I kind of makes me think, I wonder if, the Japanese don't think that this is a real issue here, They're kind of all hidden away, so they're not out in the public. But then, as you said, as the accessibility gets better, more people start to come out. So then more people realize, oh, this is an issue, and there are people in wheelchairs in Japan. And so then they're more supportive of these initiatives and whatnot.
Yeah, exactly. I think a long time ago, people were a lot more hidden away. For example, when I first came, even though there was the infrastructure in place for example, the wheelchair seat on the train, et cetera, that was available, but there's nobody using it. And so I'd get kind of looks, not only was I foreign, but as a guy in a wheelchair using these things. So it's sort of first time that everybody had seen something like that. But, even sometimes now, with all the changes that have happened, I sometimes get them to go on the train, and there's already somebody using the wheelchair seat. So it's definitely making, progress towards being a more common sight. But, compared to, some city in North America, it's probably a bit fewer people out and about. A number of years ago, there was a change as well to the welfare system. Before, people with disabilities, it was sort of their family members or volunteers would be the people that would help them, so for their daily activities. And if they didn't have that kind of help, then they'd maybe go to an institution or some sort of group home. But a number of years back, they changed, maybe 15 years ago, they changed the law so that people can use personal care attendants. So there's somebody paid by the government to come in and help them with their daily needs. And because of that, they're more able to go out and, do things outside of their local area. Whereas before, it sort of feel like, people are volunteering to help me. I don't really feel like it's good to go to the movies because, that's not really what the person's volunteering to help with, et cetera. Right, but right. Now that it's their job, the person with the disability can say, this is what I want to do. So it's your job to come with me. So come with me.
Yeah.
So I think, it's definitely slower in that respect than a lot of other places around the world. But I think the pace is changing quite quickly.
Yeah, I think that's one thing good about Japan, isn't it? Is like you said, they don't kind of half-ass anything. It might take them a long time to make a decision. Yeah. But once they do, it's implemented countrywide. It's you would never see a situation where there was something being built in Tokyo and it wasn't being done in Osaka. They would just, they treat the whole country as one. And they're like, okay, you're putting in ramps everywhere. And then boom, it's everywhere. Whereas in Canada, you would have one station in Toronto and maybe, one in Edmonton and one in Vancouver or something. You know what I mean? It's so hard to roll anything out Canada wide, but.
Oh yeah. And then the government changes and then they put things on hold or they change, et cetera.
Right.
Yeah. So there's no budget this year or whatever, but nothing half-assed about the Japanese government. So.
The one thing that I've always hated, and I'm not even in a wheelchair, but I've always imagined if I was in a wheelchair, I would hate it, is that movable chair thingy that they attach to the side of stairs in train stations. Okay. Have you ever seen that when you got four stairs or something like that, and they have that kind of like that track stuck on the side of the wall?
Yeah,
and then
yeah.
you sit on the chair and you move up. And whenever I see that, to me, it just looks like, are you kidding me? Like, that's the best you could do to design something to move this person, four flights of stairs? It's just four or five stairs. And you have this massive contraption to move 10 feet. Really? There isn't a better solution than that?
No, there used to be a lot more of them. They're gradually changing, but they're still, I'm still surprised sometimes. When I'll go to a station, it's like, oh, you still have that, huh?
Yeah.
So, and then I have to get on that. And actually, they're very rare now, but there's another one in Japan where basically what it is, it's a regular escalator, except for the fact that when you put it in a special mode, that three of the steps become a platform, so they all go up together, so a wheelchair can ride on it.
No kidding.
So it's pretty interesting. It's pretty interesting engineering, but it's terrifying.
Oh, is it? Okay.
there's no guardrails to prevent you from falling down the steps, so you sort of have to trust the people who are operating it. But I mean, you can't operate it by yourself. You need to have staff there to help you. But I mean, I'm a big fan of elevators. I'm glad they're increasing.
Yeah. Is elevators the solution for a lot of these things? Like, would a ramp be a solution, or that escalator option be a solution?
I guess it depends on the distance. I mean, a ramp would be just as fine if it's just a few steps, for sure.
Right.
And sometimes, in Kamakura Station, they have an elevator that goes up, I think, 5 steps, whereas, you could just build a ramp and then it wouldn't have to worry about that.
Right.
I guess they're a case-by-case kind of thing. A lot of times they're sort of inconvenient locations as well, but that's because they're sort of put in after the fact.
So
it's sort of they don't put them in the necessarily ideal position. It's more of we can put in here, so let's put it in here.
I really think like more people with disabilities should try to get into urban planning, because I'm always impressed when I see smart urban planning that's fully accessible but it's not obvious. You know what I mean? Like an elevator in the middle of nowhere, or that like seat thingy is like, it's so obvious. And to me, when I see that, it's like, okay, someone is not thinking here. Like, they're not planning this out. They're just like, oh, I guess we need to do this, so let's just think of the easiest solution. Just slap it on. So I'm always impressed when I see mentioning to Tony when we're discussing, he said like there's, on the handrails of all the stations in Japan, there's Braille at the bottom of the handrail. So if you walk to the bottom of the steps, you just touch that handrail, you can feel the station name with the Braille. And
I never known that before.
It's really clever to me. That seems really smart, because it's not only on top of the handrail, it's on the bottom. So everybody using that, like everybody, regular people, sighted people using that handrail are not going to notice it. But it's still there for people who need it. And it's not out of the way. It's not inconvenient or anything like that. It's just really smart design. So whenever I see something like that, I'm like, that's great. More cities should do that.
Well, I heard another one. I think it's shampoo bottles and conditioner bottles. I'd never noticed it, but all of them are standardized in a way that I think it's conditioner. It's sort of got a different pattern in the shape of it. So you can, even people who can't see, can sort of figure out which one is which. And it's sort of been standardized, but again, nobody recognized it because it's sort of so well hidden in that way.
Yeah, that's kind of clever. I kind of like that. So one of the things I wanted to kind of talk about on this show is your experiences of traveling around Japan. You run a website now called Accessible Japan, where you discuss and write articles about accessibility in Japan. And I think this could be a good resource for anyone listening to this show, because the last time I did this show, I interviewed this lady who was in a wheelchair, and that interview was more about her experience of just traveling around Japan. And that was like in 2011. So I'm kind of thinking that maybe for this show, this would be more kind of like a how-to for anyone who might be thinking about coming to Japan. They can get some like real information, so they don't have to, scour some old library or something like that. So maybe you could start off with kind of like transportation and your experience. Like, we've touched on it a bit already, but like, what has the transportation been like? What's some good things about it? What's some struggles that you've had with it?
Right. So transportation of, I guess when the first thing is, when you arrive at the airport, and all the airports in Japan are up to international standards, so you're not going to have any surprises there in terms of accessibility. Most of them are quite well planned out and easy to get around. One of the things that I think is sort of especially unique in Japan is, or at least well done anyway, is the thing called a universal toilet, or sort of a multi-purpose toilet is what they call them usually. And it's a sort of a separate toilet. So there's the men's toilet and the women's toilet, and there's sort of one separate toilet. So it's the standard room with the toilet and different facilities available for people with disabilities, or maybe parents, etc., or elderly. And so you'll see some really good examples of that in the airport. And so sort of, you know, a really good introduction. We can probably come back to that later, but that's one of the good things about Japan. In terms of trains, et cetera, trains and subways, I think pretty much in any major area for Tokyo or Osaka, Kyoto, the majority of trains and subways are accessible. The law requires that any station that has over 3,000 daily users be accessible. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean it's perfectly accessible, but it would mean that there's at least some sort of route that you can take to be able to use the train station. So, you know, some of the newer stations or the better stations, they'll have, you know, you're going through the regular ticket area, you go up the elevator and get on the train easily. Whereas some other ones, you might have to sort of go out a different train line's exit or something like that, or use the elevator or shopping mall to get down to the subway, etc. So, you know, they not necessarily obviously accessible, but they are at least they have a possibility of being accessible. So in any area that is large, you'll be fine for getting around, I think, in trains and subways.
And, you know, let's just say, too, like some of you who maybe live in a small town, North America or even in Europe, you're thinking, well, 3,000 people, that's a lot. But no, in Japan, it's not. Like, that covers probably 90% of the stations out there, because most stations have millions of people going through it. So if a station has 3,000, that's a really tiny station here in Japan. So that means that most of them will be accessible. And I've actually noticed that a little bit too. Like, you notice some of the ticket stalls, like when you walk through, some of them are really narrow, but they always have like one probably close to the station attendant that's actually pretty wide. So you can get through there.
Yeah.
What about getting your ticket though? Like buying your ticket from the ticket machine. Is it too high? Can you reach it or what?
It really depends. I think in general, they're lower than a lot of other places. So you could probably work your wheelchair in beside it if you want. Again, it also depends on, you know, the person's disability, right, how much they can do by themselves or not. So I've seen people in wheelchairs that have, you know, full use of their arms, then they can do it no problem. Probably somebody who has more difficulty with using their arms will probably be with somebody anyways. But even if they're not, then they can always ask the station staff and they'll help you with those things. They're very, very helpful with that. So you can get that. And then from there, you give your ticket to the station attendant and you tell them where you want to go, and they will help you down to the tracks, or maybe tell you to wait a certain track. They'll come with a sort of a portable ramp to help you get on. And then they call ahead to either where you're transferring or to, you know, where it is you're getting off. And even if it's a transfer, actually, a lot of times, even if it's a different company, the two staff will meet each other and sort of pass you off to the other company. So it's a very smooth system. I've lived in Tokyo for 13 years, and if all of a sudden that system went away and I could get around perfectly easily without any help, I'd probably be lost as somebody who just arrived, because I sort of turn off my brain whenever I get on the train, because I sort of trust them. So I don't have to worry about, you know, trying to make my way through Tokyo Station, because there's somebody who's always guiding me. So, I'm quite spoiled in that effect.
Yeah, I've actually seen that a number of times. I should film it and maybe post it on my channel, some of that, because I think it's a really fantastic system, is that you tell the attendant where you want to go, they come down with you, they have a ramp that allows you to, you know, get onto the carriage, cover that gap there, and then they radio ahead to whatever station you're getting off at, and they tell the attendants there what carriage you're in. So you arrive, and then they roll out that ramp, and then you just come over, and you're all good to go. So, and like you said, like the trains in Japan run on time all the time. So it's just an absolutely fantastic system. And if they painted that thing red, it'd almost feel like you're like getting the red carpet treatment, won't you?
Exactly, and also it works for people who have visual impairments as well. They can request assistance, and so then the station staff will guide the person who can't see to the train, and they'll also, you know, help them get into a seat, and then they'll call ahead and somebody will guide them out of the station at the other end as well.
Yeah, so, I've seen that before. I've seen that with Japanese people who have like the cane and whatnot. I've seen that. That's really good. I will say one thing though, that I think for anyone who needs this type of assistance, brushing up on your Nihongo is going to be really key, because, you know, the attendants here are probably not great in English, and if you need to try to communicate to them where you're going, there, that could be a challenge. And if you're, if you don't need their assistance, then, you know, you can just walk through, no problem. But if you need to communicate with them, there, that actually could be a bigger barrier than just literally trying to get on the train, you know? So, before you come here, memorize like all the cities that you're going to, and maybe learn a little bit of Japanese in regards to like directions, left, right, straight, up, down, whatever. Cause I think that will make it lot easier.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. But speaking of trains as well, the Shinkansen is a little bit of a different experience, the bullet train. There are accessible seats available on the bullet train, but you generally need to book them in advance. So even if you have a JR pass, it's a good idea to book your rides ahead of time. Usually, my JR recommends 2 or 3 days ahead of time at least. But you know, you can even book them when you arrive right off at the airport if you want. But if not, you should maybe probably at least try to get there a day or two to make sure that you can get the seat you want. Now there are, you know, if you're going from, for example, Tokyo to Osaka, you know, there's trains every 10 minutes or wherever it is. So you're likely to be able to find some seat available. But the accessible seating is not in the online system. So you can't buy it at the regular kiosk or online. You actually have to go to the ticket gate to order it. And then it takes some time to do the arrangements, but that's the way you have to do it.
Interesting. Is there any additional cost to that, or is it the same as a regular ticket?
No, it's the same as a regular ticket, and you can do it with your JR pass as well. Just that you need to do it ahead of time. Even if you do it on the same day, it's not impossible, but you might end up waiting. You know, if somebody who doesn't need a wheelchair seat, you know, they might get on the train right away, whereas somebody who does need a seat, they might end up waiting, you know, an hour or an hour and a half, whoever. So you don't want to necessarily leave it to the last minute.
Right. Have you taken many buses here or taxis?
I have taken buses. The city buses, that's an excellent point, actually. There are two types of buses in Japan. The regular city buses that run around the city. In general, if it's a bigger city, they are all accessible. The middle door in the middle of the bus, the bus driver will stop and he'll put a ramp out for you to get on, and then two of the seats will fold up so you can sit in the bus there. You do have to sort of signal the bus driver that you want to get on, and sometimes they may have to, you know, rearrange the bus to a spot where they can put the ramp out. And that's pretty good. If you go to a smaller town, though, they have, you know, budget constraints, etc., and it might be that only every third bus is accessible, or only buses on this route are accessible. So you do need to sort of think about those things in advance if you're going to a smaller town. For bigger buses, the highway buses or the airport buses, in general, they're not very wheelchair-friendly or wheelchair-friendly at all, because they have the suitcase area underneath the bus, and then the seats, you need to go up maybe 4 or 5 steps to get into the bus. So if you have a manual wheelchair that you can fold and that you can either do a bit of steps, or if you don't mind somebody carrying you, then that's fine. But if you use a power wheelchair, you won't be able to use those buses. Right now, let's say, I think Tokyo Airport Limousine, they have 1 or 2 buses that run per day that have a lift on them. So you can use those, but again, they're sort of at their own schedule as opposed to maybe necessarily when your flight's coming in. So it might not be very convenient. There's a little bit of both, I think, for buses.
That's a good point, actually. So what do you recommend? If someone's coming into the airport, the good thing about Japan is there's no end of options for transportation. You know, you can, there's like dozens of trains that come. It's actually confusing for most tourists because there's like, there'll be so many options. And the thing is, if you ask a Japanese person, they won't just tell you the easy answer. They're going to want to know precisely how long you want to be on the train. You know, like if you want to be on for 34 minutes, take this train. If you take this train, it'll be 37 minutes. It's like, what? Really? You need to tell me that? You know, but what would be the, I'm guessing the train would be the option. What would be the best option, you think? That the local train is about 600 and some odd yen, or that Narita Express, or what do you think?
It would,
I guess it depends on where in Tokyo you're going, right? But
yeah, exactly. I've used Narita Express. It's sort of similar to the Shinkansen, is there's where the wheelchair space is. But you don't need to book in advance. Again, you might need to wait a little bit. But in general, probably the regular train is the easiest way to do it. However, you're going to come into a challenge with the number of suitcases you have, or for example, a lot of people with disabilities, maybe they can't pull their own suitcase, so the person with them ends up having to take both suitcases. So having a long ride can be a challenge. So I mean, the easiest thing is a taxi, of course, but then that sort of has a little bit of a problem as well. Right now, Japan has been trying to increase the number of accessible taxis on the road, and so Toyota invented a new one called Japan Taxi. It's sort of it's called Japan Blue. It's sort of a navy bluish color. It looks a lot like a London cab.
Yeah, those kind of tall and, roof ones, right?
Yeah, and unfortunately, they're very, very unpopular by both people who need to use them as well as the drivers. Unfortunately. Because the way that they designed the ramp, instead of just sort of a quick pull-down ramp, it's all folded and put away in a box. So they have to put it out, and I think it's two different pieces, so they have to assemble it and get it together. And so the drivers don't really like that, because that time they're using to put up the ramp, they're not getting paid, as opposed to if they took a different fare, they probably already be being paid. So they're not huge fans of that. But also, because of the height of the van, if somebody's using a foreign wheelchair that's maybe a power wheelchair, they might have trouble getting into the actual wheelchair van. So they're better for somebody in sort of a push wheelchair like you'd see like in a hospital. Right. They're fine for those, but if you're using one that moves around electrically, then you might need to use a bigger wheelchair van, which are available. But they usually require some sort of prior reservation. And unfortunately, a lot of the companies that run those aren't very focused on foreign visitors. So you won't really find any English information on those. So it can be a bit of a challenge. And most people end up just taking the train.
Yeah, it's funny how picky the Japanese taxi drivers are about their car. You ever stop, like for me, I know like whenever I flag one over and I have my suitcase and I want to put it in their trunk, they make all this big huff and puff. Oh, I got to get out and rearrange my trunk to put your suitcase in. It's like, dude, that's your job.
Exactly.
But even my mom said that. My mom is Japanese. And one time she said to me, on her last trip, she's like, boy, those taxi drivers don't like putting my luggage in the trunk. I said, oh yeah, they hate it. Like they got all their towels arranged in there and it's all perfect. And then you're disrupting it. But yeah, I guess one downside with the taxi also is the cost, because the cost to go from Narita to Tokyo would be substantial. So that's something that someone's going to have to consider. Don't come to Japan, hop in a taxi because Josh told you to, and then get a $300 bill when you arrive at your hotel in Tokyo.
Thanks for saving for a minute. Angry tweet later. I took one from Narita once. And I think it was about Nimayen, so it was about $200 maybe.
Yeah.
So definitely not something you want to do. Definitely probably the train is really the best option if you're coming from Narita.
Yeah, I think it is an interesting challenge, isn't it? Because the local train will be cheaper. It's only about 600 yen, so about $5-6. But because it's cheaper, it's going to be more crowded. And so it's not only crowded with regular people, it's crowded with regular people and their suitcases. So the space on the train, or the local train, is limited. If you take the Narita Express, or I always take the Skyliner because I live near Ueno area. So the Skyliner for me is fantastic because it's almost like a local Shinkansen, that's an option. Just trying to think off the top of my head. I don't know how accessible it is or not, but it only goes to like one, that specific area. It goes to Ueno and then I think Nippori and that's it. So,
It does have an accessible seating on it. I have looked it up, yeah.
Yeah, so then the Skyliner is great if you're staying in that area. But otherwise, I guess maybe the local train is probably best and try to get as close as you can to your hotel and then maybe hop in a taxi from there.
Yeah, well, the biggest benefit is that, the airports generally tend to be the last or the first station or the last station. So you can usually at least guarantee a seat and place to sit down and put your suitcase.
Yeah, but that's true.
It can be difficult. Yeah.
The other thing to consider too is taking an Uber, because Uber is here. It's not as popular with the Japanese, but there are Uber drivers here. And, as you mentioned, the language barrier, the good thing with Uber is everything is done through the app. So I think you can request a van directly from the app. But okay, then again, yeah. I guess won't have any, they may not have any ramp or anything like that. So I guess, yeah, that's kind of an issue.
Yeah, it might be good for some people who, you know, maybe are okay with getting out of their wheelchair and putting it in the trunk or something like that. So,
yeah.
I mean, it's really hard to give advice on these kind of things because there's such a huge variety of disabilities that you know, you can't say that, you know, this is fine or this is not good, you know. Tell what's available.
Yeah. So. I've used Uber before when I've had to move some stuff. And I just request a van. And yeah, I know you can kind of you can select that. So yeah, I think for coming here, but I think overall transportation in Japan is probably pretty good, isn't it?
Especially if it's public transportation, I'd say it's probably the best in the world.
And then what about staying in a hotel? Because I've always kind of wondered about this because I stay in a lot of business hotels in Japan, and these things are tiny. Like I can barely turn around myself, and I thought like, how is someone like, especially if you've got a big power chair, how are you going to move around in here? So what's that been like?
Yeah, unfortunately, that's one of the areas where Japan has been quite a bit behind. And there's a huge pinch before the Olympics and Paralympics. And, you know, there's been even, you know, some international things about, you know, the IOC getting upset that there weren't enough hotel rooms, et cetera. And so, yeah, they're really just first the first problem, I guess, is that there aren't enough rooms available. For example, if you go to the States, with the Americans with Disabilities Act, there a certain guarantee of a number of different rooms that meet a different certain standard, and they all they'll have different grades. So you have a standard room and a deluxe room and a a suite or something like that that are all accessible versions available. Whereas in Japan, up until now, the laws have been very relaxed, shall we say, about what is required to be an accessible room, as well as the number of rooms that are required by a hotel. Up until now, hotels with fewer than 50 rooms are not required legally to have an accessible room. They can have one if they want, of course, but there's no legal requirements that they have one. If you have more than 50 rooms, then you are required to have an accessible room. Up until this year or last year, I think it was, if you have more than 50 rooms, you're only required to have one room after that. So if you have 51 rooms, you have to have one accessible room. If you have 500 rooms or 1,000 rooms, you're still legally only required to have one room. So the number of rooms that are available are obviously very low. I think the latest statistic was that it was about 0.4% of all the rooms in Japan are wheelchair accessible. So quite the slim pickings. They're changing the law now, so it's a bit more proportionate. So if you have 100 rooms, then you have to have one accessible room. If you have 200 rooms, you have to have two accessible rooms. So about 1% of the rooms must be accessible. I think still think that's too low. But the other challenge on top of that is because the standards were sort of very loose as well in terms of what makes an accessible room. So if they're required to have an accessible room, and then they sort of left up to the hotel, and the guidelines were basically, that there are no steps in the room and that you can move around in a wheelchair, but sort of that's about it. So I've stayed in lots of different hotel rooms in Japan, and so sometimes you'll stay in an accessible room and it ends up looking like a medical facility because of all the things they've added to the room, and the white tile bathroom that looks like it's from a hospital or something like that. It's not very nice. But then at other hotels I've stayed at, I've been, trying to figure out what makes this room accessible other than that they have one handlebar by the toilet. So you get a huge variety. So it's a little bit, frustrating trying to find an accessible room because you don't know if it's going to meet your needs or not. So that is another challenge. There's one third challenge, I think, is also that trying to book an accessible room is also a bit of a challenge. For example, most places, they'll have online booking, but you can't select an accessible room. In other countries, a lot of other countries, you can check off a box, I want the accessible room. Whereas in Japan, that doesn't really seem to be very, very common at all. So you either have to book online and then try to contact the hotel and say, I want the accessible room. Other than that, you need to contact the hotel directly and reserve either by phone or by email, which sort of adds an extra layer of frustration trying to book your trip, especially if you're not quite sure if the party on the other line understood what you're saying, etc. Being in business hotels, Toyokuin, they have really good accessible rooms, actually. And they're all standardized across the whole country. But unfortunately, the only way to book them is by phone. So if you're trying to call from Canada, you have to call at a good time to call, and you have to make sure you speak Japanese. So there's a lot of barriers, I think, for people coming from other countries who want to book accessible rooms.
Yeah, I think that, you know, that's the case for almost anyone coming to Japan, is that if you need something out of the norm, it's you almost have to try to do it. What you need is a Japanese person to call another Japanese person in Japan to figure out what the solution is. Because, I mean, Japanese companies can barely answer email to begin with, right? And let alone try to some kind of requests like that. And like you said, like they're not going to understand what accessibility is unless you actually tell them, you know, like.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that is. And, you know, an accommodation in Japan is a challenge for anybody because there's just been a severe lack of availability here, even before the Olympics.
Yeah. So if somebody's going to be planning on coming, I really recommend making your decisions early. And at least guarantee some, you know, even if you can always, the cancellation rules are the same. So you maybe get, a safety hotel, at least book something so you at least have something, and then after that maybe you can do some more detailed searching after that, and then if you find something better, then cancel your original booking. But at least have something in advance that you know you can fall back on. So
yeah, because a lot of the rooms here are really small, aren't they? They're not the same size as a hotel room in Canada or the States. So
Oh, no, not at all.
You have to consider that. Like the bed literally might be like a half a foot from the desk, So.
Yeah. Well, actually, one of the things that I was surprised when the first times I came, I didn't realize this is that a lot of, especially the business hotels, they'll have a step up into the bathroom and where the toilet is and stuff like that. Yeah. And to me, coming from Canada, I never even thought that that might happen.
Right.
So I stayed in a hotel room that was like that. And how am I going to use the toilet? So it was definitely a challenge. So maybe a lot of times people will think, oh, well, in my own country, I can just do the regular room and I can manage with that. But I wouldn't assume that you can do that here in Japan because the regular room might not be what you expect.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And you know what? When you call a Japanese company or hotel or whatever here, you cannot ask them, is the room accessible? You have to ask them specifically what you mean, because you say, is the room accessible? And then that person answering the phone goes, yeah, I've seen a wheelchair person come in and out of that room. But then, what you said is there could be a step up inside the room into the bathroom. That's super common. I've seen that in almost every business hotel I've stayed at. So they might not be aware of that. They might be aware of it, but they might not be on their consciousness. So when you ask them, is it accessible? Yeah. They're like, yeah, sure. Yeah, no problem. We've got a bar in there or whatnot. But it could be, you really need to ask them, can I go everywhere in the room? Are there any steps in the room? Is the whole floor flat? Can I move around? You have to be really specific. Mm-hmm. To get them to kind of think about this. What's interesting? I'm just looking on Airbnb. I was kind of wondering if Airbnb is an option. And I'm just looking on Airbnb and I do not see an option to check for accessibility, which I'm actually quite surprised to see that. I would have thought Airbnb under one of their filter options would allow you to check an option to filter out for accessibility, but I don't see that. Oh, wait. Accessibility, find a place to choose feature. Oh, no, it does have it right here. Oh, wow. So a whole, that's pretty good. It's a whole separate page.
Yeah, I think it depends on the country as well. Some countries, I think it rolled out in the States and Australia, et cetera, before it came here. And I think it's newer here in Japan. But again, it's sort of you really need to ask because somebody might think, it's fully accessible. There's just one step or something like that, So communication is really, really important.
It's like when you ask Japanese people, is that meal vegetarian? They're like, yeah, it's just fish. It's like, what? Wow, so Airbnb might be an option, actually, because I'm just looking on this. They have like a whole list of options here. So Airbnb obviously hired someone who knew what they're doing, because it's like entering the space, no stairs or steps to enter, wide entrance, wide hallways. In the bedroom, it's like accessible height bed, wide entrance, bathroom, no steps or stairs, extra space around the toilet, grab bars, step-free shower, all kinds of different options you can check here. So maybe Airbnb might be a better option than trying to contact a regular Japanese hotel.
Yeah, it's definitely an option, yeah.
What about the tourist attractions? Like, what if someone, like you mentioned, you went to Akihabara. What if someone wants to go to, like, Sensoji Temple or Akihabara or Ueno Park or all these other places? How accessible are these places?
Yeah, I think that tourist attractions are getting very, very good at being accessible. Sensoji is incredible for accessibility. Everything is completely flat. They did that intentionally. Originally, the main gate at the front where everybody takes their pictures, there were steps there, but they removed them and made the whole area flat. And then at the main temple, they added an elevator at the side. So they put in a lot of effort. And there's a number of other temples and shrines that are putting more and more effort in. I mean, I think another big part of that is the tourism, but also because of the aging population here in Japan. Right. So there are a lot of grandmas and grandpas that, you know, want to go to the temples and shrines, and they have, you know, to use a wheelchair. So there's a lot of, that's also a reason for the changes. I'd say for a large number of the tourist attractions where it's sort of one place as opposed to an area, one place, they generally tend to be accessible. On the website, I have reviews of a number of them. The challenge becomes more when you want to go to an area. So, for example, going to Akihabara or going to Shibuya or something like that, where, I mean, it's a tourist attraction, but it's also, you know, a city area. So the accessibility can be quite varied. So you'll be able to find some accessible places to eat or to go shopping, but there'll be a lot of places that are not accessible. So for cultural tourist attractions, fairly good. For things like going out for food or drinks with friends or going shopping, you probably have a lot more challenges than in other cities, I think.
Yeah, I guess it's just like a regular neighborhood, right? Like Akihabara or Shibuya, where it's just a regular neighborhood. So you're right, it's like some areas might be accessible, some areas might not be. But the actual attraction itself most likely will be fairly accessible.
Well, if it's a cultural like heritage site, then sometimes accessibility cannot be that great because, you know, there's only so much they can change about the site to maintain the status. So there are some places where you can only go this far because after that it steps and they can't put an elevator in because it would, you know, damage the site or something like that. Right. So I mean, those things, yeah, still exist. But
one thing I've wondered is how do you find getting around in a power chair in a place like Shibuya? Because I've always wondered this. It's so crowded. The sidewalks are so crowded and so narrow. Like, do you find it difficult at all, or just people get out of your way, or what?
People are fairly good about it. For example, I challenged maybe Takeshitori in Harajuku.
Yeah.
That can be very, very difficult. It's sort of, I end up just sort of going along with the flow of people and sort of just going where that takes me a lot of times. It can be difficult to cut across or something like that. I think particularly in a wheelchair, you're kind of a bit lower than other people, so everybody's sort of looking ahead and they don't really quite see you. So in those crowded areas, I end up tending to look at my feet a lot because I'm trying not to bump into people. And so it, you know, it can be a little bit less enjoyable, but it's not, yeah, not impossible, but yeah, I guess it depends on your tolerance for those kind of things.
How have you found the Japanese people's reaction to you here versus the people in Canada? Because I imagine both countries, you probably get some looks, right?
Right.
Like, the reason why I ask is that, like, I had a friend of mine who's like a black girl, and she told me, like, here in Japan, she's not perceived as a black girl, she's perceived as a foreigner.
Right, right.
Whereas back in America, she's like a black girl first, and then, you know, but here in Japan, they're like, oh, you're just a gaijin. So I've always kind of wondered, like, people just look at you, oh, you're just a gaijin in a wheelchair. Whereas in Canada, you'd be like that guy, that wheelchair guy, you know? Like,
yeah, I think in Canada, definitely it's the guy in the wheelchair. Whereas here, it's the foreigner who's in the wheelchair guy. I think that's better. I'm not quite sure. I mean, I think it sort of helps, you know, I've heard from people who have just Japanese, you know, there's quite a bit of a difference as to maybe how I'm treated compared to somebody else in a wheelchair who is Japanese is treated because of being foreign, that, you know, I'm still you know, I'm the guest, right? So even though I've been here for 13 years, so there's sort of a little bit of a benefit to that. People are a bit more willing to go out of their way for me than for somebody who's been born and raised here and is Japanese and is in a wheelchair. So I think, you know, having a foreign aspect to that does help in that area. But and I think sometimes it does sort of take away from being disabled, you know, it's supposed to be in Canada, just being the disabled guy kind of thing. So,
right. You're just a foreign guy.
Yeah.
Like the Japan is the great equalizer, because no matter what color you are, how you get around, you're a gaijin in Japan.
Yep. Like
you could be a blind black person in a wheelchair, and the first thing the Japanese will see is, well, he's a gaijin.
Exactly.
Tell me about your website. What made you start it, and what are some of the bits of information that you offer on your site?
Yeah, well, I started it because, I wanted to, you know, travel someplace, and I found that there wasn't really much information available, and it was kind of frustrating. And I remember back to when I first came to Japan and how little information there was here in Japan about accessibility in English. And I thought, you know, well, that's, now that I'm living here, that's something I could do. I could sort of write about my experiences. So, you know, like your previous guest, you know, sort of shared about her personal experiences here. The site sort of started off a bit like that. You know, I went here and I did this kind of thing. But then I thought, oh, well, I should maybe make it into a bit more of an almanac or sort of a basics of travel in Japan. And so I started adding in things like, you know, how to use the train or finding accessible restaurants in Japan. Or actually, speaking of the language thing, I created a Japanese English dictionary for disability words that's on the site that people can use as well. I think the biggest thing for me was that, you know, I was mostly focused on wheelchair related accessibility. And I had a number of questions from people who are using the site that are not wheelchair users, but have different disabilities. And it was sort of a challenge to me to create more of an all encompassing site. So for example, somebody who doesn't use a wheelchair, but they use a walker and they get tired easily. So they want to know about things like, you know, are there places for me to rest or sit down on a bench? And so I never thought about those kind of things because I'm always sitting in my wheelchair.
In Tokyo, there's none.
Yeah.
Tell them to go to Moscow. Moscow is the best city in the world when it comes to public benches. They're everywhere. They're huge. I love it. In Tokyo, there's like two or something like that.
I'll tell them that. But also things that, you know, like if they can bring guide dogs, if they're visually impaired, or if they, you know, have a dog for helping them out, you know, how to bring them to Japan or what medications they can use here in Japan. So it sort of had a lot of just general information from getting around to the basics you need to know before you come. But then also I have a list of tourist attractions and sort of a brief description of their accessibility, as well as hotels that have accessible rooms listed. Try to put as much information as I can there. Wheelchair accessible day tours that people are running, I try to introduce those as well. As well as I also have a forum on the website so people can ask questions. There's so many things that, you know, I can't put on the website because I haven't thought of them. And so if somebody asks a question, like, oh, that's a good thing, I should add that to the site. So sort of like the Japan guide, except for people with disabilities.
Thanks again to Josh for coming on the show. And if you want to find out more about his website, you can do so at accessible-japan.com. And, you know, I think this is a really important topic that probably a lot of people don't think about. I mean, it's not certainly I ever think about because unfortunately for now, I don't need a wheelchair. But if you think about it, that Japan was projected to have 40 million tourists come to Japan this year. That was their projections before COVID came along and basically put that on ice. But if 40 million people were projected to come this year, I think it was like 32 million last year, so 40 million people. So if just 1% of those 40 million need some kind of accessibility, that's still 400,000 people. That's a lot of tourists, a lot of people that are coming here that need this information. So it's nice to see that Japan is kind of slowly getting there. And you would actually think that Japan would be at the forefront of this, wouldn't you? Because, I mean, a quarter of the population is over 65. The population is getting older and older. So you think, like, mobility issues and all that would be at the forefront. I think part of the reason why it's not is because the Japanese are so damn fit. You know? They're so fit and ganky. They're like, you know, live to be 100 and they're still active out in the rice fields and all that. So maybe the planners don't think about it as much. And also, too, I think, like Josh said, it's kind of hard to suddenly, you know, change the infrastructure when things weren't built like this originally. But definitely sounds like, in terms of like transportation, Japan does a pretty good job. In terms of accommodation, I agree with him. I think it is a lot harder. I think partially due to the space constraints in Japan. Like even just booking a regular size hotel in Japan is tough. So I think Airbnb might be a better option for someone who's coming here because they'll at least have a list of options. And you can kind of be sure that whoever rents an Airbnb that has an accessible room will really understand what accessibility means. Like you said, like these giant hotel chains, like most of the hotels in Japan, they cater to business travelers. There's very, very few that cater specifically to tourists. So that's their biggest group is these business travelers. So, you know, tourists are kind of a secondary, and any tourist that needs secondary is just kind of almost an afterthought. So I think Airbnb might be a better option in trying to find a place for you to stay. So anyways, I hope this show was helpful for anyone that needs it. And if you are looking to come to Japan, do it. It's a really fantastic country, and hopefully you won't have any problems getting around. But definitely check out Josh's website and do some planning beforehand, because you don't want to have any surprises when you get here, you know, like taking a taxi from the airport. That's going to be an unpleasant surprise. So anyways, that wraps up this episode of the podcast. Thanks for listening, everybody. I'm your host, Anthony Joe, and talk to you next week. Bye-bye.